301 in San Francisco. Joan Benny has arrived and looking forward to talking with her about her dad, Jack Benny, and the book, Sunday Night at 7. They wrote it together, kind of, actually at different times, and we'll explain that as we get underway in just a couple of minutes. She'll be with us till 3:45, so if you'd like to call with a question, a comment, or a reminiscence, you're welcome to join our program this hour. And we've got the car phone quiz coming up at 3:55. Then Gene Washington and Sports Page 68 at 4 o'clock today, all from the Giant 68 KNBR.
Sure is dark tonight. No moon. Oh, well.
Da-da-dee-da-dum. Hey, Fudd. Fudd.
Huh?
You got a match?
Yes, I have one right here.
I'll make a move. This is a stick-up.
Listen, put down that gun.
Get out. I said this is a stick-up. Now, come on. Your money or your life?
Look, Bud. I said your money or your life. I'm thinking it over.
Funny guy. And with me in the studio is Joan Benny. And together, they have authored Sunday Night at 7, the Jack Benny story. But not quite simultaneously, right, Joan?
That's right.
So you found the manuscript to your dad's autobiography in a file cabinet?
Well, it's something like that. By the way, you know, that routine still makes me laugh. I've heard it hundreds of times, and every time I hear it, I laugh again. My father wrote the autobiography in 1968, which was 6 years before he died. And at the time, I remember that he was writing it, but it was one of many projects. He was doing a lot of things at the same time. And then I didn't pay a lot of attention to it. At some point, I guess he finished it. We never really talked about it. But as they say in show business, fade out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, 1983, my mother passes away, and there's all the memorabilia left, which of course now belongs to me, and there's rooms and rooms full of boxes and trophies and canceled checks and scripts and contracts and, I mean, on and on and on. And among all this stuff was this manuscript. And when I found it, actually I didn't, someone else found it and mm-hmm. called me and said, you know, there's this manuscript that looks like an autobiography. And with not any great excitement, I said, oh, yes, I remember that. I remember, well, what do you want me to do with it, he said. I said, well, drop it off at my house when you have a chance.
Mm-hmm.
And he did. And it took me a couple of weeks. I was very casual about it. It took me a couple of weeks, and one day I saw it sitting there on a pile of things and thought, well, I'm going to look through this. And I started reading it. Well, it was wonderful. I mean, beginning with his very early childhood. Now, Daddy wasn't a man who looked back. He always looked forward. So I didn't know a lot about his childhood.
Mm.
Oh, he reminisced with George Burns. I mean, they would talk about vaudeville and the old days and so on, and that was great fun. But generally, he really didn't talk on his own
mm-hmm.
to me about his childhood. So I'm reading this thing, and I'm finding out all kinds of things about how he first started to play the violin, how he daydreamed, how his first job was with his father at his haberdashery, and his father fired him.
Right.
I mean, all these wonderful stories that I had never heard.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, this really should be published. I think perhaps it wasn't at the time it was written because, my father says in his own introduction, he said if I'd known I was going to write an autobiography, I would have had 3 or 4 affairs. But I lived such a blameless life, you know, who's going to want to read it?
Mm.
So I think that was probably the reason it was never published in the first place.
Because he thought it wouldn't be that exciting?
It was colorful. I mean,
really?
He had a very... the curve of his career just went steadily up, like, you know, the mathematical curve.
Mm-hmm.
And he hit star, at, you know, towards the end of the 30s. And then he remained a star, and then he died. I mean, you want to put it on a mathematical curve.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what it was. And he thought, well, it's just, you know, there were no setbacks, there was no trauma, there was no tragedy, there was no scandal. And so it wasn't published.
Mm-hmm.
And
did he have a very, I don't want to make it seem like he had a low opinion of himself, but he didn't have an inflated opinion of himself. That's the feeling I get from your words and from his.
He was a paradox. He was an extremely egocentric man, and I don't mean that in a negative way. He couldn't have been the star he was had he not been centered on that show. I mean,
mm-hmm.
everything focused on the next Sunday show. And he didn't get away from it very far. He would talk, you know, certainly his family and baseball and golf. But it was like a horse with blinders. He was pretty centered, and there was that egocentricity. But he was, as I said, the paradox. He was the least egotistical man
mm-hmm.
I've ever known. He was amazing. He was really very casual, very happy-go-lucky. People called him Jack. I mean, he was informal. You wouldn't have thought of, he didn't care what kind of car he drove. That just didn't interest him.
Uh-huh.
The joke interested him, you know.
Right.
The guest star interested him. He didn't know that there were certain tables at restaurants that were better than others.
Uh-huh.
Very simple man. He had great enthusiasm. This is the best glass of water I've ever had in my whole life. I mean, I used to break this up. But he really meant it at the time. Great enthusiasm over simple things. On the other hand,
uh-huh.
he once went to the Caribbean, to an island where they didn't speak English. No one asked for his autograph. No one recognized him. And he was home the next day. He didn't like that.
Oh, really?
So, as I said, the kind of paradox. He really enjoyed being a star.
Uh-huh.
Very much.
Interesting. And for you, I mean, this book is loaded with so many memories, but was there any discovery in this, something that just bowled you over about your dad, maybe the days in Waukegan, maybe, you know, the road to success, but something that you just never expected to think about in relation to your dad?
I wish I had a really wonderful answer. I can't think of anything unexpected, but there was so much I hadn't known and as to how he got started. And so much about his life became clearer to me, and so much of the way he was became clearer, learning more about his young life. But there was no great revelation of any kind. When I mentioned, you know, finding the manuscript and then thinking, well, this really should be published, and then, of course, I came up with the idea because I've been doing some lecturing on growing up in Hollywood, and I found my audiences so curious about what life was like being the daughter of a celebrity in
uh-huh.
Hollywood at that time.
Living next door to Lucy and Desi.
Exactly, and the Jimmy Stewarts,
uh-huh.
and up the block was Eddie Cantor and Ira Gershwin, and down the block was Jack Haley and Hedy Lamarr. I mean, it went on and on.
Yeah.
And so it occurred to me what a good idea to kind of combine two stories,
uh-huh.
like, you know, Jack Benny by Jack Benny, and Jack Benny as seen by his daughter.
Yeah.
So it is a kind of intertwined dual autobiography.
And we'll continue with Joan Benny here on the Giant 68 KNBR. If you have any comments or you'd like to talk with her, lines are open, 956 KNBR from the South Bay. It's 575 KNBR. Right now, Skyview traffic update at 314. Here's Kim Wunderlich.
Are all those houses on Roxbury by any chance?
Roxbury is correct.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Just because I know we drove by and look at the old Lucy
you
house.
You took a map of the stars, right, and stopped at every one.
No, we saw the Lucy house, and that was about it. It was too confusing to figure out the rest.
Oh, okay.
next door.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, really?
Yep,
oh,
right
neat.
Next door.
Neat
and we'll tell the story about how the neighbors before Lucy and Desi okay. put up a sign saying, Jack Benny lives over there.
Oh, great. True.
Joan okay. Benny is my guest. We're talking about the book she wrote about Jack Benny, Sunday nights at 7. And you describe, I think, rather vividly, the pattern that your dad had, particularly on Sundays, as he geared up for the show, and you were a part of that early in the day.
That's true. When I was quite young, I don't remember what happened in the later years, but I just had this vivid memory of when I was about, I guess, 5 or 6 years old, and of Daddy driving me to Malibu. We would go together to Malibu, and he would talk about the show and make me feel that I was very much a part of it. It was, you know, the highlight of the week for me. Like, you know, the fans always remembered Sunday nights at 7.
Uh-huh.
I remembered Sunday mornings at 10. or 9, or whatever it was that we went.
And did he try out material on you?
Oh, I don't remember whether he did that, but it was just such a nice, you know, father-daughter time.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, I was Daddy's little darling, you
right.
know, his only daughter, so he spoiled me terribly. And even allowed me to eat the foods. We'd go, you know, I'd get a Coke, which I wasn't allowed to have at home,
mm-hmm.
or things like that. It was
mm-hmm.
it was great. I have very fond memories of those days.
Now, celebrities and their families these days are very defensive, very protective, and you can't imagine, Sean Penn or Bruce Willis or any of these people being able to go out and, you know, take your shoes off and walk along the beach in Malibu on a Sunday morning and not at least feel self-conscious, if not, have your privacy interrupted. How did your dad deal with that? Was he protective? Did he keep people away from you? Or if he was recognized in public, did he enjoy that and include you?
Oh, sure. But it was a very different time. We weren't security conscious, really. If there was any security consciousness, it may have been from the long-ago Lindbergh kidnapping. And I think
mm-hmm.
there was a kind of fear about kidnapping. And we did have an alarm. We were one of the few. I think some of the celebrities had alarm systems in their houses where, very simply, there was simply a button by the front door. I mean, there was nothing fancy, not like Westech or the security systems today. There was simply a button. If you pressed the button, an alarm went off in Beverly Hills Police Station and by all the doors, and I believe in my parents' bedroom. And that was about it. But other than that, as far as I know, we left our front door open. People today, you know, they're behind gates and in their television, and they've got the screens going, and the guards with the guns in their hip pocket. I mean, you know, I'm pretty soon they'll have moats and alligators.
And you tell the story of one night watchman who, the only time he used his gun. Tell that story.
We had, this was our security. We did have a night watchman. And, but he was a retired policeman of some sort, a retired some sort of guard. He was, well, I thought he was elderly. He was probably 40, you know, but for a 10-year-old, he seemed quite old. And he walked around the place. He made his rounds at night, and he did carry a gun. I don't think the man had ever used the gun, but he carried one. And one night, he walked into the powder room, and the powder room, of course, was all around mirrors. And he saw movement in the room, and he shot. And of course, he shot the mirror. He had seen himself. That gives you an idea what a wonderful security guard Frank was.
Let's go to the phones with Joan Benny, Rick in San Francisco. Line one, you're on the air at the Giant 68 KNBR.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering if you'd tell me what happened to the film George Washington Slept Here. I've been looking for it all over, and they say it's not in print. It's not shown on TV anymore.
Gee, I don't know what happened to that film. I have a... Oh, you know something? I'm not even sure I have a copy of it. I have copies of some of his films, but I haven't played them in a while, and I don't remember which. I guess it's something you just have to watch for, and maybe someday they'll release it in, you know, in a videotape form. I'm sorry. I wish I could help you.
Okay.
All right, Rick. Thank you for your call, and thanks for holding so patiently. This brings to mind, a couple of weeks ago, a film critic was here, and we were talking about the real lack of quality preservation of old films.
Oh, you bet.
And it really varies widely from one studio to another, depending on whether there's a successor to one of the great studios of the past and just how much they've invested in preserving these things.
I don't think they have any great interest in preserving them. I think, you know, they have the, here's your budget. It's like our United States budget, you know. It's, this is for defense, and this is, and there's very little left over for things that are quite necessary, or that some people think are necessary. Obviously, it's not among their priorities. The same is true with archival material. Enormous amount of my father's archive is at UCLA. Some of it exists at the University of Wyoming. And by the way, I think they do a better job. And by, I don't mean this as a negative about UCLA, but UCLA doesn't have the funds to catalog and to, you know, keep the dust off.
So it's in a warehouse somewhere.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's got to be hard because there's so much great work. I mean, and even the networks, the television networks, often were so cheap when videotape was developed that they would maybe save the tapes for a year or two, and if they decided they weren't going to rerun them, you know, we'll put game shows on that tape. And, of course, a performer over years, you're so close to it. You don't know which is memorable and which isn't. That's just show number 43. And you talked about your dad's study at the house that eventually was just overflowing
with
his collection.
But also what happens is, I think at the time, you don't realize that these things are valuable. You don't realize that they should be preserved. I have a very funny story about all this memorabilia. Much of it was boxes and boxes and boxes, and I could go on for half an hour saying boxes and boxes, of canceled checks that went back 30 years, checks signed by my father to the market, to the drugstore, to the cleaner. I mean, this kind of just household checks. And stacks of them. Well, when I first went into this office after my mother died, and it was three rooms, as I said, floor to ceiling, I just closed the door and went out. I said, what do I do? I don't know where to begin. I don't know. What do I do with this, and how do I begin? And I found an archivist, and he's the one who actually did it. But in the meantime, I thought, well, I guess I could get started. And I took boxes of these old checks and threw them in the trash. So when this wonderful man, Chuck Sachs, the archivist, arrived, and he started cataloging everything, and he said, I'm going to take a couple of these checks to the office and see, because he had a showroom. He said, let me see what I can sell them for. So, you know, it has to do with the tax deductible thing. We can prove that the check was sold for. So he sold a couple of checks for, I guess he got maybe $1.50, $2 for an old Jack Benny canceled check. And I said, you got $2? I said, I must have thrown away 20,000, 30,000 checks. I mean, it never, who would think that a that a check would be worth anything.
Right.
So you don't know at the time, and that's silly, the checks, but it's the same thing with these old tapes.
Right.
You do a show, it doesn't occur to you that maybe 30 years later, somebody might want to hear that.
Yeah, but I'm going to save the tape of today's show. I'm not sure what I'll do with it, but I'm going to save it. 328, Joan Benny, my guest, will continue on the Giant 68 KNBR. In the 50s, when a serious move got underway to save the Palace of Fine Arts, architect Bernard Maybeck suggested surrounding the palace with redwood trees and then letting it die behind those trees of its own accord and become its own cemetery. But in 1957, just before he died, he had a change of heart and wrote that the palace was probably the last of the traditional pieces of architecture to survive the modern age. Finally, with funds from the California legislature, the city, the Palace of Fine Arts League, and private donations of more than $4 million from Walter S. Johnson, the palace was saved, and in 1962, plans for its restoration in concrete were started. In 1964, the entire structure was demolished and rebuilt anew, including the decorations and sculptures, and the classic weeping ladies which adorned the tops of the columns. In the course of reconstruction, the rotunda was reproduced in its entirety. When it was completed and everything restored, the palace was beautiful, reflected in the lagoon in front, and yet still an empty shell. Then in 1965, that changed. Tomorrow, enter Frank Oppenheimer. Joan Benny is my guest here on the Giant 68 KNBR. We're talking about her book, Sunday Nights at 7. It's actually their book. It's the Jack Benny story. And it's nice the way you put Jack's memoirs, the excerpts from his autobiography, in a different type. And we can see the text that you've woven around it. And I think it's a very interesting approach. You talk in the introduction about your own struggle with how to do this. And I just want to tell you, I think you arrived at the right method.
Thank you. You know, what's funny about it was I say something in the beginning about the fact that it was a 400-page manuscript. Well, what I didn't realize until actually last week, I mean, I was already on the road with the book, and somebody said, well, you must have cut an awful lot out of that manuscript because this book is only 300 pages and half of it is yours. What I never realized was that that manuscript was triple-spaced. I mean, I'm not really a writer, and so I wasn't aware of, you know, when you convert a page to a page and it comes out. Actually, the whole manuscript is there with very little exception, but it was 400 pages, triple-spaced.
Right.
Well, why'd you cut so much out of us?
Now, did he dictate it, or did he actually write it?
No, he wrote it with a ghostwriter at the time, and then when it was not published, he paid the ghostwriter to retain all the rights himself, and that was what happened.
Well, one thing I'd like to correct, you know, your dad's humorous persona in some ways was very different from the real Jack Benny. He wasn't a cheapskate, was he?
Oh, not at all. He was the most generous man.
Mm-hmm.
There's a wonderful story about, do you remember the one about the hat check girl when he overtipped her and she gave the money back and said, oh, Mr. Benny, please don't disillusion me. No, he tried very hard to overcome that image in real life.
Mm-hmm.
He overtipped.
I liked the miserly persona, though. I mean, it always made me laugh. I remember the Texaco commercials that ran for years.
Well, the nice thing was about when you say the miserly person made you laugh, he was a very unusual miser because he was a very nice miser.
Mm-hmm.
You think of a miser as Scrooge, you know, bah, humbug, and this awful personality. He was a very sweet miser, and you loved him. Even though he was cheap, you really liked this man.
Yeah.
And he kind of reflected the foibles, I guess, of most of us. And I had, in a way, the same problem Daddy did with, who's going to read a book about a nice man? It's not Daddy Dearest.
Yeah.
Fortunately, when I first turned in the manuscript to the publisher and said, you know, is anybody going to buy this? He said, it's refreshing. And I thought about it, and again, I mentioned I lectured, and it's interesting, the people who come up afterwards and say, it's refreshing. You know, we're so tired of hearing all the dirt and the scandal and the Hollywood children who didn't like their parents and who rebelled and the awful childhood. There's like the Mommy Dearest kind of thing. And, you know, here was a very happy Hollywood childhood, which was mine.
You're not another victim of Beverly Hills?
No, Beverly Hills is a wonderful place to live.
It sure seems like it every time I drive by there. Let's go to Ruth in Sonora, line 2. You're on the Giant 68 KNBR with Joan Benny. Line 2. Here we go. Ruth, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Great. Go ahead.
My father, who was born in the 1870s, was the executive director of the YMCA in Waukegan. And as a small boy, He always said it was the first performance that your father did. Anyway, Benny Kapelski played for the YMCA.
That's nice. I hadn't heard that before. Thank you for the story.
So we grew up with Jack Benny, as you can imagine.
Mm-hmm. And there's a Jack Benny High School in Waukegan.
That's right, junior high school.
A junior, yes. Huh? All right. Well, Ruth, thank you for sharing that.
That's my pleasure.
Okay.
That was the proudest moment of his life because he never finished school, and the idea that his school was named after him.
Mm-hmm.
Truly, proudest moment.
Yeah. Did he ever play the violin for pleasure? Or was that after all those years that it became just a prop?
He played every day. He practiced 3 and 4 hours a day. He took 3 lessons a week. He loved it. That's what he did for relaxation.
Mm-hmm.
Later. Well, he quit the violin when he was in his 20s and became a comedian. And then he went back to it in his 50s, and it was when he went back to it that he realized he had missed it all those years, and he went back with a vengeance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's one story, is it Isaac Stern, who,
yes.
He was on a double bill for a benefit, and Stern, I don't want to blow the paraphrase here, but he made some comment that it takes someone who's known for being bad at the violin like you to get people to pay $100 to see somebody who plays well like me.
That's right, yes. That was true.
That had to be fun for him. Freddie DeCordova, you saw him just a week or so ago when you were on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of
it
people...
It was 2 nights ago, actually.
Oh, was that recently? Okay. A lot of people know about Freddie as Johnny's producer.
Yes.
But they don't necessarily, at least people in my age group, connect him with the Jack Benny shows,
yes,
on radio and TV.
He was, no, not in radio.
So he was the producer.
It doesn't go back that far, but in television, yes, he was the producer of my father's show before that, or after my father's show. He did Father Goes Best.
Mm-hmm.
He had a long career in television, but he was, not only was he the producer of the show, he was really one of my father's closest friends.
Uh-huh.
Closest friends. And his wife, Janet, was one of my mother's closest girlfriends.
Uh-huh.
So we saw a great deal of them, and I'm very fond of both of them.
Mm-hmm.
Freddie, by the way, is as funny as any comedian.
Well, you know, that's what I was going to ask you about next, is the creative process in developing Jack Benny's humor shtick and the routines that he did on TV. Because after a while, the volume of material he was putting out was so great,
mm-hmm,
that certainly he had to rely on others. And you talked about some of the meetings that would take place at the house and all kinds of clippings and little notes to that Jack wrote to himself. But how much of it really originated exclusively from him, and how much of it came from others?
Well, of course, he had 4 writers through most of the days. The early days of radio, there were 2, then 4. And they were with him for many, many years, the same 4 writers. But he did write his own material for Friar's Roast, for tributes, when he had to make a speech about something. Generally, he wrote those himself. The show is the radio show, and later the television. The writers wrote the first script. They divided into pairs. So one pair would write the first 15 minutes, another pair would write the second 15 minutes of the half-hour show. Then, once they had that done, all of them would get together on, say, Wednesday. And now they started with word one and went through the half an hour, word by word, phrase by phrase, sentence by sentence. By the time it was done, it perhaps didn't bear very much resemblance to what they had started with, but that was the basis. My father was the editor, final say. It was like the Harry Truman, the buck stops here. What you saw on Sunday was truly the Jack Benny show.
Mm-hmm.
He was totally responsible for everything that went into that show.
Yeah. And what was he like when he had a show that didn't come off the way he wanted, when he'd come home on a Sunday night? Was he the kind of guy who would second-guess himself and say, I shouldn't have done that, I should have left that out? Or was he the kind of guy who just moved on and said, well, that's the show, it's
he
over, I don't
on.
Have to worry?
He moved on.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, he didn't look back much.
Yeah.
He always looked on how I'm going to improve for the next one, you know,
mm-hmm,
and if this was a mistake, I won't do that again kind of attitude.
Yeah. John, I want to thank you for joining us here today after flying in from Seattle. I hope your luggage catches
yes,
up
you
with
too.
You. And enjoy your visit to the Bay Area.
Thank you so much, Peter.
Delighted to meet you. Sunday nights at 7, The Jack Benny Story by Jack Benny and his daughter Joan, who has been our guest. It's published by Warner Books. Should be in your bookstore around the Bay Area. Oh, Joan Benny's so nice. I talked about Milton Berle in the Texaco commercial and mixed it up with her dad, and she was too polite to point it out to me. 3:44.
How did you find out?
She just told me off the air.
Oh.
But I don't mind having my mistakes exposed.
Well, that's just the kind of guy you are, Peter.
Skyview traffic time loaded with mistakes.
Yes, really.
Inaccuracies and fabrications. Here's Kim Wunderlich.